Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
First of all, welcome to, again, the Center for Entrepreneurship and Technology, the Distinguished Innovator Lecture Series. It's a very busy schedule today. Of course, you know me as your host, Iklok Sidhu. Today, we have two acts in combined into one. We have two parts to today's presentation. The first is that we're going to have a discussion between Vivek Wadhwa, who you've already been introduced to before, but I will reintroduce, and Mike Arrington, who I will reintroduce or introduce the first time as editor of TechCrunch. And after this, so I'm going to come back to these introductions in 1 second, but at approximately 5:45, we have a distinct honor of being able to also have a presentation today from Juan André Fontaine, who is the Minister of the Economy of Chile. And you'll see all of these things are related because some of these things have been talked about in TechCrunch. And it's really just very coincidental and fortunate that we can actually have all of this put together into one program. So without a lot of extra time, I'm going to go ahead and do a quick introduction here. Let's start with Vivek. Vivek, as you know, he is a scholar, a serial entrepreneur, and a writer. He's connected with Harvard, also with Duke, the engineering school at Duke, and here as a visiting professor at UC Berkeley, and my co-instructor, effectively, in this course. He writes for Business Week, and you guessed it, he writes for TechCrunch. Now, along with this, we have our main speaker, if you will, Mike Arrington. Mike is a lawyer by training. He has a law degree from Stanford, and I say that in the most positive way. But even more important than that, he spent 1 year here at Berkeley. So you are therefore a Berkeley alum. He's a serial entrepreneur, and then part of his entrepreneurship involves the creation of TechCrunch itself. And I think with that, I've basically introduced these two. To some degree, Vivek, this is really your show, since you've created all the magic to pull everyone here together. So I'm going to hand it over to you, and then we'll have our guest after that.
So the weird thing over here is that I'm the professor interviewing the entrepreneur, and the entrepreneur happens to be a journalist. I mean, it's sort of a bizarre world where I'm getting to interview him, and I've been getting tweets all day from people who wanted me to rip him apart on, quote, rip him apart on this issue or that issue. But I tweeted back.
Is my mic? Oh, my mic's on. Well, that's perfect. Just leave yours off.
I tweeted back that since I'm wearing my professor hat today, I'm going to be polite.
How much time do you spend a day tweeting?
I don't know.
A lot of tweeting going on.
That's right. All right, Mike, you're on now.
No, I'm sorry. No, all right, go ahead. I didn't want to interrupt your
so anyway,
summary of your day.
This is the
guy's got a TechCrunch T-shirt on over there.
I know. I mean, we're proud of you.
Where did you get the T-shirt? And he gave you his T-shirt?
Don't give out names, please. All right, Mike, tell us about yourself. I mean, how does a lawyer go from being a lawyer to being an entrepreneur?
So first of all, it seems pretty clear we're like a warm-up act, right, to the Chilean Minister of Finance?
No, Chilean Minister of Finance is here because Mike Arrington is speaking.
Yeah, well, yeah, we go way back. I'm actually anxious to hear about, he's got an iPad. That's they sell those in Chile now?
Yeah.
I was talking beforehand with Nicholas about how Chile's opened up its immigration rules or its visa rules for entrepreneurs, and just about anyone now, an entrepreneur can get a visa for a year and then go from there. And I wish we had that here.
I know.
You know, that's a way to grow an economy and
absolutely
to get startups going, is to just open yourself up to the world's smartest people and say, come build a startup here. So we haven't written about that, have we?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, actually, we should have, and we should write about it. We should get an interview and talk about it.
So, right, absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry, what was the question?
Okay, tell us about yourself. How did you go from being what you were to being what you are now?
I'm happy to do that, but I think we should spend a lot of time talking about issues if we can, right. Because I don't think I'm all that interesting myself.
Mike, you'll be surprised. These students are very interested in your background.
Raise your hand if you really care about my background.
They're looking.
It's
everywhere.
Like half. It's like half.
No. I counted 90%.
So I went to Berkeley for a year, my first year of college, I enjoyed the school. Didn't love having classes of 900 people, so I transferred out and went to Claremont McKenna in Southern California, and it was a good fit for me. And then law school, I went to Stanford, which is great, clearly the best school in California. I'm just warming up the crowd.
Right.
Just warming up the crowd.
Mike has a habit of doing that, pissing off half of the world in one fell swoop.
I obviously did two amazing schools. Went straight through the law school after school and then immediately joined a law firm. And didn't know a thing about technology, but immediately was sort of getting to know technology because a firm I worked for was Wilson Sonsini, which represents most of the big companies and startups. And I found, just to merge your next question in, I found pretty quickly that... being a lawyer wasn't all that much fun. It was like, you know, we'd be brought in on these big deals, but it was like after the handshake was done and the term sheet was signed, then I'd get involved. And I felt like sort of an outsider, a hired gun, which is exactly what I was. And I wanted to be, even as a young lawyer, I wanted to be the guy making the deals happen. I wanted to be the mover and shaker, not the lawyer inking stuff once it was done. So I quit pretty quickly and joined a startup. Kind of went from there. I started four companies, one of which sold for $30 million, but I had raised 20 in venture capital and didn't make I made almost nothing off of it, and there's a whole talk in there about raising venture money and how you can sell a company for $30 million and not get rich. And eventually just started TechCrunch on a whim. It gets us where we are today.
What are the top two or three lessons that you learned along the way from success?
Be very careful when you raise venture capital. So when you raise money, the venture capitalist, there's a few terms that are really important to negotiate. So one is the valuation of the company, because you're getting X dollars, company's worth Y dollars, you know, that determines how much of the company you're giving away for that money. That's obviously the most important thing to negotiate. Say the second most important thing to negotiate is what's called a liquidity preference. And what that is when you sell your company or go public, the venture capitalist will take a piece of that money. They have special stock called preferred stock, and depending on how it's structured, they get first dibs, and sometimes they get lots of money before the founders take any. So in our case, I did what was a standard deal at the time, which was a 2x liquidation preference. Mm-hmm. And that meant when we raised $20 million, the first $40 million in an acquisition goes to the VC before the founders start to take any money. So the only reason why I was able to get anything out of the deal was we had voting control of the company, and we could have killed the deal. And we didn't really have many options, but they had to give us something to vote for the deal. And so we made enough to buy a car, really, nothing more. Right. So I'd say, you know, be really careful. When you're negotiating with a VC, there's a couple terms in there that you really need to know what you're signing off on, because you can have a successful company and do it and then end up not making any money. The other thing is to choose your co-founders really carefully. Your core team, it's so important that you get along with them, at least in certain ways, to have a successful company. More companies than I can count I've seen be ripped apart by fights among the co-founders, the initial employees, and the founder. And that doesn't mean you have to be buddy-buddy. In fact, most founders end up hating each other, and it's perfectly fine. It just means that you have to have the same level of commitment. You have to have a clear idea of who's doing what in a company, and people have to do what they say they're going to do. And you see too often, you not even have that basic level of communication. And I've had that happen in my past as well. Right. Yeah.
If you had to do it again, what would you do differently, other than negotiating with the venture capitalists differently?
If I could do it again, I would have started, I would have learned how to play the guitar in junior high, and I would have been an international rock star right now. I think that would have been nice. Although I'm not really musical or artistic in any way. So I will say one sort of thing I would have done, to be serious, is I would have gone to business school instead of law school. Law school taught me a lot, but nothing that I'm using today. Wow. And it seemed like the guys over in the business school were having a lot more fun. Mm. And so I would have gotten a business degree. One is the sense of camaraderie in a business school is significantly higher than it is in law school, where it's much more competitive. But it also, it seems like it's a little bit more about what, you know, creating and building and doing, as opposed to litigating and constitutional law and just, ugh. So.
You know, one of the debates I've had on TechCrunch, one of my articles was about the value of MBA degrees. And I was surprised at the negativity in Silicon Valley, that somehow an MBA is considered to be a big negative over here in this part of the world. You seem to be a lot more positive about MBAs.
Well, I said I'd rather go down to business school than law school. You know, there's this whole debate as well about whether you should just go to college at all, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, Mark Zuckerberg dropped out, Bill Gates dropped out, and countless sort of high-profile entrepreneurs. I think Larry and Sergey, did they even get their degrees? I don't know. I think they dropped out.
Oh, go ahead, please. Bob.
I mean, before we completely say that you shouldn't go to college, all these companies, how many people?
I wasn't
going to
say that.
Need?
You totally cut me off before you even heard what I was going to say. You did. You totally. I was actually going to go in the opposite direction. Are you talking about they need people to actually do stuff?
Yeah.
And you need a college degree to know how to do things, because
right.
You don't learn on the job. Okay, I'm going to change my whole answer now. So I think that college is a due diligence process. It's so great. I have a mic, and you absolutely don't. Let me say, okay, so first off, let me say, there are truly special and gifted people in the world that going to college is a huge waste of time, and they need to go out there and do what they're going to do. You know, there's probably no one in this room who's like that. I'm certainly not. And maybe there's one person in this room who can do it. Other people, they need to go to college to mature, to go through a process of learning, to learn how to be social, things like that. But I'd say that if you're making a decision like, wow, I've got this startup and it's going really well, should I continue or should I drop out of college? Dropping out of college is not always the wrong choice. I think that college is, I didn't learn that much in college. I think what it is, it's a process of due diligence and thinning out and sort of a certification process. Like you went to this school, you went to Berkeley, you must be smart. As opposed to you went to Berkeley, you must have learned a lot and now you're smart. You know what I'm saying? And so it's just sort of a way of employers saying, okay, well, this person clearly is intelligent because they went to this school. I don't think there's a stigma attached to dropping out anymore, though. I think the best thing in the world is go to Harvard for a year and then drop out. You know, everybody knows you were smart enough to get in, but you didn't have to spend the years, you know, messing around with the degree. So,
you know, I have to disagree with Mike on some of these points. That all the research I've done, all the data I've seen, basically shows that having
you and
a
your
degree,
data, you always have a study. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Having a degree makes a huge difference. Completing what you started makes a big difference. I mean, in fact, my view is that after you finish an MBA, you should get a few years of experience to learn on someone else's nickel about the basics of building a business.
Statistically speaking, if you have, you're saying, don't let me put words in your mouth, but statistically speaking, if you have a degree, you're more likely to succeed.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So statistically speaking, does it make any sense at all to start a startup ever, or does it make sense to go be an accountant or a lawyer and make that, you know, that nice,
Mike,
solid...
Statistically speaking, you have to expect to fail a few times, and eventually your rate of success increases a lot, and you learn a lot, and you grow a lot along the way.
I would argue that most entrepreneurs don't make any money and would have done far better never being an entrepreneur.
Well, we can debate that.
I think the numbers would actually show that pretty clearly. And the, you know, I often have said, like, it's sort of like being a pirate, being an entrepreneur, right? Because you're out there and there's like this chance that you're going to find that ship and make it big, right? And get the gold treasure. I don't know much about pirates, but get the treasure ship from wherever to wherever and get rich, right? But like, most of the time, you're not going to make, you know, you're going to be sailing around doing absolutely nothing. You're going to end up dying poor and alone, right?
Like,
and
it, so, it
but it's because of the glory that people want to be entrepreneurs, because of that chance of doing something that changes the world that is so amazing. And if you're the kind of person that's going, I can increase my chances by getting that master's degree, honestly, in my opinion, you're not an entrepreneur. You should be out there like ready, fire, aim. And those are the guys that I see that seem to be doing the best.
Mike, this is where we've had disagreements on TechCrunch. So yeah. We would always disagree.
No, and I respect your conclusions, even though I think they're dead wrong and somewhat dangerous. And so, it's interesting that, like, you show data showing that older entrepreneurs tend to be more successful than younger entrepreneurs. In my world, that's not the case. In my world, older entrepreneurs, I mean, I'm ancient now, have no chance of even raising venture money.
That's part of the problem over here. The stereotype about entrepreneurs being young college dropouts, that's what the problem over here is. And you have a few who've been successful who stand out. But it's not all or nothing in entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship, you can build a very successful lifestyle company, learn a lot, grow a lot, and live happily. You don't have to make $1 billion to be successful.
No. I think that you have to aim big. You know, VCs talk about entrepreneurs who fail as being
thinking
small.
Most VCs fund a tiny proportion of companies. The world doesn't revolve around VCs. VCs would like you to believe
my
that.
My world does. Well, I think maybe that's I'm not talking about mom and pops, you know, starting a bakery. I'm talking about somebody, you know, building new technology that's going to change the world. That's generally a VC-backed company. And maybe that's why we're different in our what I see and what your stats show might be different because you're looking at a much larger population.
I'm looking at the tech and engineering universe, which is what these people are. They're not all Web 2.0 type of entrepreneurs.
No, I mean, you know, you're going to build a, you know, a new type of, you know, chip. You're probably going to need some money.
You're going to build a medical device. You could probably make $20 or $30 million over 10 years and still be very happy and successful. You've done good for the world.
So, but there's this theory with which, going back to what the VCs say, regardless of whether you respect them or you need them, they say that when you think small, you sort of end up small. Right. And you know that if you think in terms of $1 billion opportunity and end up with a $30 million one, that's okay. But if you think I want to build a $20 million business and have a nice lifestyle of this, that you're probably much less likely to succeed if you do that.
Well, it depends on how you define success. Success isn't all about building a $1 billion business.
How do you define success?
Building a good company which pays the bills, being able to support your children, and learning and growing. That's success to
me. So why not just go be a lawyer?
Because you're not your own boss. When you're an entrepreneur, you're your own boss. You can make an impact.
Okay, then open up a McDonald's franchise. I mean, what I'm saying if you want to change the world, go change the world, right? And you can't let family and
not everyone has to change the world. You can make a small impact and be changing your community and be happy.
But I'm not interested in people who aren't trying to change the world.
Well, that's majority.
But I see why you would.
Majority of these kids aren't like that.
Who wants to change the world? Really? At Stanford, every single person would have raised their hand and say, who wants to change the world?
A lot of them here will want to do good for the world as well. A lot of them will want to build good lifestyle companies.
See, but you're arguing me into a corner by suggesting that doing good for the world is not something you do.
Greed is your number one, making money is your number one objective. You don't necessarily do good for the world. And that's why you have these scam bills, and that's why you have all these companies
that you write about.
The obsession with making money.
First of all, I think that's a different topic of staying within the rules, and I'd love to talk about that. But I think the people who are really, really good at making money should go and make a lot of money. And then they should give it all away to charity, like Bill Gates is doing.
Agree with that.
Because I'll tell you, I want to do good in the world. Like, my girlfriend Jen would probably like me more if I was the kind of guy that was like helping stray animals or something, right? And it would like generally make me seem like a cooler person. Right. But I gotta tell you that like what I want to do is make a ton of money and then like let other people go help the dogs and stuff, right? Because I think I'm good at making money, and there's nothing wrong. Like, I think a culture of saying that's wrong and you're a bad person and you don't care about the world is a terrible culture to perpetrate. I just don't think it's a good idea.
Let's switch gears, because we can argue this for an hour, but let's switch gears and talk about ethics and integrity. These kids are going to join companies which lack integrity, which lack ethics. That's the way of the real world. What's your advice to them when they're faced with a dilemma? If I speak up and if I expose this wrongdoing, or if I talk about the fact that we're screwing our customers, I'm going to hurt my career, versus speaking up and doing it. What do they do when they're in that situation?
Well, it's pretty easy. If you were faced with an ethical dilemma, I think you always know what the right decision is. And I think that some people talk themselves into doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. But I think deep down you always know. I've been faced a couple of times in my career with dilemmas where I've seen things going on that have been wrong. And in both times I've simply quit and walked out. It's never been good for my career in the short run, but in the long run it's been fine.
I think this is something which I strongly agree with you on. Because I've seen your writing as well, that you've never hesitated.
Well, I think I see the world in black and white almost too much. It's good for blogging. I think sometimes, like, I see, you know, this is right, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. I think in the real world, there's a little bit more fluidity to right and wrong, but there's not that much more. Right? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, like, Scamville, what you were talking about, what Zynga did was just wrong. But also, it was wrong of Facebook to allow that to go on, and they got their cut. Right. And do you guys know what I'm talking about with Scamville? This is Zynga a year ago was allowing people to pay for credits in games with doing things like mobile offers and things like that. They were pretty sketchy, and people didn't really know what they were getting into, and they were making a lot of money off of it. And I wrote about it quite a bit. And I think that was just clearly wrong. And I would never want to be involved with a company that did that. But I think Facebook was just as wrong, and no one really blames Facebook.
Well, some of these kids are going to be working for the next Facebook. And this is why I raised this question that I agree with you 100%, that you have to do what's
business,
right.
Business ethics are really important. And you know, just before I left for here, I wrote a post on something that was involved this. So you didn't see this because you've been here doing this. But last night, I walked into a room at a bar where there were 10 of some of my best friends in the world were sitting around the table. They're all super angel investors. And they kicked me out, and I didn't know why. It turned out they were actually having a meeting to collude on price fixing, and to sort of talk about how they can negotiate against Y Combinator companies and how they can keep VCs out, how they can keep other competitors out. Really bad stuff. And a few of them now I've talked to, and they feel really bad about it, and they were there, and they felt uncomfortable and all this. But to me, it was sort of black and white. Like, why would you even, like, start that? And I can see how you slippery slope. First you're having a conversation, then it's a bitch session, and then suddenly you're price fixing. Yeah. But at some point, like, you just say to yourself, what we're doing now is wrong. We should stop doing this.
Yeah, I agree. This is something that I want all of you to just remember and take with you through your careers, because this is the most valuable advice that you'll ever receive. Do what's right.
And change the world.
And change the world. Absolutely. I agree with that as well. By the way, I've been one of those people who always wanted to change the world.
Look how lucky we are. Like, we don't... my parents' generation, my dad, and my mother and father, my dad especially, grew up, and they were hungry sometimes. Like, they didn't have food every day. They're pretty poor. I mean, I grew up middle class, and I've never been hungry a day in my life. I've never had to sleep outside because I didn't have a place to sleep. I mean, we live in a Shangri-La where we can do what we want. We can make what we want of our life, and we can express ourselves and create and become something sort of ideal, and not have to worry about feeding ourselves. Like, take advantage of that incredible luxury of not only do the right thing, never hurt someone to benefit yourself, never hurt anyone, period, but also do something amazing, however you define it, something amazing and change the world.
I agree with you 100%, Mike.
Well, that's an easy thing to agree with.
I agree. Let's talk about what we disagree on now. Let's talk about women. I mean, you somehow made yourself very popular with women with your post saying that it's their problem. There's a dearth of women. Every bit of data you look at shows that women are underrepresented, they're disadvantaged, they're discouraged, and there's a societal problem which is keeping women from succeeding in the tech world. You seem to disagree with that, even though I've actually been defending you on the Twitter sphere more than anything else, because
you and Twitter.
Because you are.
And I appreciate that.
You hired a woman as your boss. Okay, you have strong women around you. You have never hesitated to promote them. You don't discriminate. It's very rare that you see people who are totally open-minded. Yet your post that you did said the exact opposite, and you made yourself a target for many women's groups, and that's not the Mike Arrington that I know. What's going on here?
I think, I've seen discrimination against women. Not being a woman, I haven't been the subject of discrimination against women, so I wouldn't know exactly what it feels like. But I've seen it, and I've seen discrimination against other races, and I've seen discrimination against people based on their age. For example, when I was at Wilson Sonsini, the law firm, I was shocked coming just out of school to be sitting in a room with a bunch of partners, door closed, the women's secretary is outside, and then the jokes and the words and you can imagine, like, it's we're talking like Mad Men type stuff, just bad. And I was just like, whoa. And it shocked me. And that's the legal world. And I think that, that world and investment banking.
Investment banking is the same. I've seen the same thing there.
I can tell you that personally, I've never seen that in any form in startups. Just, I personally have never seen that. Women are, in my world, respected as much as men. It has absolutely nothing to do with their sex. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means I haven't seen it. Now, when I started a company, I needed to hire a CEO because I suck at managing. So I hired Heather. I didn't go, if I hire a woman, that'll be great. That'll get bonus points later. I hired her because she's amazing. She ran M&A at Fox. She has a Harvard business degree. She's awesome. She's a stud. And she agreed to come be our CEO. Of our senior editing staff, including me, there's four of us. Two of them are women. I think almost half of our employees are women, and that's, heavily weighted towards senior.
If the rest of Silicon Valley was like that, you wouldn't have this problem.
No, but look, I mean, Jen, for instance, right? Jen, can you stand up for a second? So Jen, Jen just started a company called Artist, R-T-I-S-T. She's raised no money. She's self-funded. She has a team that she's hired. The site launched on its own, is doing very well, and she's a woman entrepreneur. I mean, I've asked you this. Have you ever felt like, wow, I think that I'd be doing better if I was a man?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you haven't tried. Have you been in front of venture capitalists? Have you had them ask you, well, how does your husband feel about it? What's going to happen when you
come
have a kid?
On? That doesn't happen.
It does happen, Mike.
If it did happen, I would shame that person.
I have spoken to at least two or three dozen women who've tried raising venture capital. Talk about venture capital. Let me tell you my own experience over here. Okay, I started two companies.
You're getting fired up.
Yeah, right? I am. First one I took to I was the number two in the company. We took $220 million of revenue. We were based in North Carolina. Second company, I put my...
That's not even the United States.
All right. Well, You're right. And here's what happened. When I put my business plan out there, local VCs wouldn't return my phone calls. Eventually, I had...
I would imagine that they'd be racist against you as well.
Here's what they said. Eventually, when they were tripping over that you give me money by the time I was done, I asked them, why didn't you bastards come to me when I was committing to you? The response was,
it's a lot. Whatever you say right now didn't actually happen. I guarantee it.
He didn't use the word bastards.
Yeah, but he didn't say because there's a woman.
No. What the response in the VC was, because you people don't make
you
good
people?
CEOs. I was a people in North Carolina.
Oh, sure. I totally think that.
But that's a stereotype happened. That women face as well. They people don't make CEOs. Yeah, Mike, this is real. You live in an isolated ivory tower. You live in your own universe. Jenna's had success.
Says the professor? if anything, I think that I'm not. I'm in the guts of everything out there. Right. We have parties. I meet entrepreneurs all the time. And I think that I meet a lot of women entrepreneurs who have been successful who said, "I if anything, it was easier."
We've got to get women entrepreneurs to talk to you.
I'll say this. At least let me frame my entire thoughts, because it's easy to pick apart what I'm saying. But I really believe what I'm saying. I think that this is a tough thing to say. You got to listen to the whole thought. But let's say you're a man and you fail. Right. You failed. If you're a woman and you fail, you could say, I fail because I'm a woman. Right? And so I hear a lot of women who've tried to get venture capital who failed who said, well, I didn't get venture capital because I'm a woman. Maybe because their ideas suck. Most people who try don't raise venture capital. And I see a lot of the, quote, ringleaders in this sort of women in tech issue are journalists who haven't tried to start companies, who are just getting everyone fired up. Right. And I think it's great for page views to have this argument and talk about it. But what we really need to do, if we want to get beyond the sort of, hey, I'm cool because I care about women thing, we have to start encouraging women to get engineering degrees in college. We have to start encouraging women to get into math and science early on in life. Right? And if we want to do things like government programs and grants to the benefit women, I'm all for it. I think anything that supports entrepreneurship is great. But to just say TechCrunch, and I was the center of this in the Wall Street Journal article, that TechCrunch is perpetuating this problem because there aren't enough women speakers at our events, it's just a way to get attention and not solve the problem. So do we want to solve the problem, or do we want to just pick on me?
Right, Mike, right? It would also help.
I say we solve the problem.
If we had the role models, so that we could get beyond the stereotypes.
Well, tell you, I'm the one taking a lot of heat for this, and I don't know, other than going through a sex change operation, I don't know how to be a better role model than hire my own boss who's a woman
This is why I started off by saying
I'm not going to have a sex change operation. I'm just not going to do it. I refuse.
Mike, this is why I started off by saying that you're a model for what we want other Silicon Valley people to be.
Well, thank you. I agree with that.
So this is why.
Yeah. But I do think that I tend to sort of, I come from a privileged background in the sense that I'm white male and all that, and there certainly are probably things going on that I haven't seen.
Right.
And because I haven't been a victim of it, it's easier for me to scoff at it.
Right.
But I'll say this, from my experience, I just haven't seen it in Silicon Valley to the extent I've seen it in lots of other industries in the United States.
Mike, and one of the reasons why I get so fired up, as you saw me do, is because I've been through it. It was my people. It was my people being discriminated against, and we had to rise above it. So this is what I think women need to do as well. Anyway, we have limited time. Let's open it up to two questions, and then I'm going to ask you one question and hand it over.
And then we're going to get the hell off stage so the Chilean Minister of Finance can say something
questions.
More interesting. Well, I think that most entrepreneurs who succeed, taking myself out of this for a second, succeed because they love what they do as opposed to it's work, and they know what they have to do to get over the finish line. And it's a blurring. Is it a hobby? Is it fun? Is it work? It's just one thing. And for me, I've had that in the past occasionally where I've really loved what I've done, and sometimes I didn't. But with TechCrunch, I just love meeting entrepreneurs. I love writing. I love doing what I do. And so it was never clear whether I was working or not until suddenly I realized I didn't have much of a life outside of TechCrunch. And that's when I sort of purposely forced other things back into my life that I'd let go. But the thing to take away from this, I think, is that, especially in your 20s, that's the time to become super passionate about something and engrossed in something and just go for it. And I think, I'm 40 now. I think now's the time to maybe start to chill out a little bit on that and think about other things.
One more question.
Where we really turned a corner was in 2006, and Google bought YouTube, and we broke that story. And, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times were saying it wasn't true, and we broke it clean, 5 days before anyone. It was my first big kill. And that's when I realized, like, I can do this. Like, we're not just a blog. We're not just messing around. Like, we can go out there and we can beat the New York Times and we can beat everyone else at tech. And we have. I mean, we are bigger than the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal tech sections combined. And I'm pretty proud of that. It's because of the writers we've hired and just realizing we can do it. There's nothing special about the New York Times. They just have great writers. So we have great writers. We'll go from there.
One more question before we... Let me switch gears and talk about Silicon Valley. I wrote about how...
Am I getting off stage yet?
No, you have five more minutes.
Oh, okay.
And then really, the minister is here to listen to you. Isn't that true? He's a movie star.
In Silicon Valley, I am a movie star?
He's the equivalent of a movie star, isn't he? Right. The minister just said that.
No, he shook his head sort of when you said it. And he's a politician, so... You know, what's he?
Right. Let's talk about Boston versus 128. Route 128 versus Silicon Valley. I've written about that. I pissed off half of my friends in Harvard and in the Boston area when that happened. But why do you think Silicon Valley is what it is? What's the magic over here?
I mean, what does Boston have to do with what Silicon Valley is, right? Well, I mean, why did it fail? It never really succeeded. It was, you know, it had a few things going on. It was sort of
in the 80s, Boston, Route 128 and Silicon Valley were neck to neck.
Yeah, but except they weren't. I mean, everything important was out here, right? I mean, you know, you've got, I mean, if you look at all the companies that matter, you know, they're all on the West Coast, including Seattle, by the way.
Actually, not at the, you know, go back 20 or 30 years, you had DEC, you had all the major mini computer manufacturers in Boston. That was the center of the universe. But it shifted over here.
Okay. Well, then I guess we won.
No, but what's special about this area?
It's awesome. I don't know. It's sort of hard to be in the middle of it, no. But I know that part of it was multicultural. I mean, just people from all over the world coming here and being relatively easy to move here and start companies. That's becoming increasingly difficult for people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sort of once something is a center of gravity, it has gravity. And it sort of continues to pull people in. Until something takes that away, it's the center. Now, I mean, really, tech should be more decentralized. I mean, the web is decentralized. Everything, you know, tech is moving towards a decentralized world, and I think that we'll start to see more and more startups around the world get really, really big. And I think China, we're going to see some of the largest tech companies in the world will be in China and have nothing to do with Silicon Valley. And that's okay. I think of Silicon Valley, because I live in Seattle now, I think of Silicon Valley more as an idea than a place and a community and sort of affirmatively trying to change the world to become a better place. Right. And that's all I think that matters, not where those companies are located.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, the next discussion is going to be by the minister talking about how Chile wants to build its tech capability.
Is all of this his entourage?
This is entourage. He's a big guy. I mean, you know, do you have a economics minister sitting there listening to your presentation for 40 minutes? It's a big deal, Mike.
It is. Oh, okay. So not strictly entourage.
And they're not young little kids, if you notice here.
These are adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the real world, my friend.
Should we let him do what he's going to do now?
Yes.
So I'll go and sit down there.
Yes, let's listen to him now.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mike, for your help in in publishing some of the things we are doing to achieve this objective of creating an innovation hub in Chile. First of all, let me explain a bit about Chile. As you know, it's a relatively small country, 16 million people. It has a GDP of $240 billion, that's similar to the size of Portugal or a bit higher than Ireland when measured at the dollars of equivalent purchasing power. So in terms of per capita income, though, it's much below Ireland or Portugal. And that's why it is classified as a middle income country. They are the main exports and famous for Pablo Neruda, Easter Island, great wine, Patagonia, among other things. I'm the Minister of the Economy, as Nicolas was saying, the Minister of the Economy has a mission as part of the government to accelerate potential growth so as to get Chile to become a developed country. And we think we're going to make it. And the reason why I'm here and thank this invitation is because we are going to make it boosting innovation. And innovation by young and talented entrepreneurs as the ones that are here, as you. Now, my view of the Chilean history first. If you look at this graph, we have this is from 1970 to 1985, more or less. That was a very difficult period for Chile. No much growth, basically stagnation. The country was basically trapped stagnation and right by inflation, things of that sort. A lot of political and social tension and convulsions. Up to 1985, in which, after a crisis there, in which we had that drop there in GDP, in 1985, we took off. I was fortunate enough to be part of the team that achieved that taking off, working from the central bank, and I did a lot of things in the central bank. But as you see, we had a very rapid growth there for about 12 years, which we call the 12 golden years, in which we were growing at around 8% per year. And had we kept that pace, at this stage, we probably would call ourselves a developed country. But it didn't happen. We have the Asian crisis in 1997, 98, that hit us very severely, in part that, which is understandable because we have a lot of trade with Asia. About 40% of our exports go to Asia, but also there were some mistakes made, and we entered a sort of a low growth period, which has lasted for the last 12 years, which we call the siesta period. In which we actually had this slowdown in growth, slowdown in productivity growth, even a small decline in productivity over the last 2 or 3 years. So our mission then is to change this sort of thing and to do so, as I said, by boosting innovation. You may ask yourself, why is it that we worry so much about this? First, let me tell you that I'm basically a public policy person. I'm trained as an economist. I've never been an entrepreneur. But I've been doing some sort of entrepreneurship from the policy side, because when you apply policies to change a country, you are actually doing that. Probably for many of you, it may sound a bit distant to this love for public policy. You are probably much more inclined for private businesses or things of that sort, which is probably part of a generation. You are part of a different generation. I belong to a generation in which we dreamt of actually changing the world, and we thought that the way to do that was basically through different sort of revolutions or of different signs, but in the end, basically to achieve a revolution. You are probably belong to a generation which tends to think wisely, I think, that the real way to change the world is through innovation, not revolution. And what we are trying to do in this model of economic policy we are applying in Chile is exactly to make a larger room for innovation and through that means to change the way Chileans live. A middle-income country tends to have a lot of poverty, unemployment, income inequality. All those things tend to get relatively quickly solved when you are able to speed up economic growth. And that's what we are trying to attempt. Our target is to cross the threshold of development during this decade, meaning basically achieving the per capita income of our of the lowest level of developed countries, that is Portugal or Slovenia, the Czech Republic. And we think we can achieve that by year 2020 by increasing by around 50% per capita income during that period, which means basically having a rate of growth of 6% per year. So we translate this vision basically in a 6% growth target, which is achievable, we think, by creating this innovation culture that would increase investment and productivity. We're doing a lot of things in this aim of making Chile the innovation hub of South America. We think we can do it because Chile is very well positioned to exploit the growth that is coming now from Asia and to some extent also from Latin America. As I said, Chile is about 40% of Chilean exports go to Asian countries, which is, as you know, the most important growth region now in the world. We are producers of many commodities of which the Asian countries lack, so that's why we export them a lot. We're also, for obvious reasons, very well connected to Brazil and other Latin American countries. This the growth of Brazil is creating sort of a rising tide in South America that is going to lift all boats. And we are seeing strong growth in Peru, strong growth in Colombia, strong growth even in Argentina. And our companies are very well connected to those markets. We feel that we can do this, create in Chile this innovation hub because we're a very open economy with free trade agreements with about 50 different markets around the world. We are very open for foreign investment. And something which is relatively new, we are seeing the growth of Chilean companies. So Chilean companies are becoming top players in their respective world markets. We have in copper, in other mineral products, in wood pulp, in wine, in salmon. We have Chilean companies being among the 10 top players in all those world markets. In addition to that, we are leading this creation of what the so-called multi-Latins, that is corporations born in South America that become a sort of regional, investing in different South American or Latin American countries. And we have in retail, in airlines, the Chilean airline LAN, for example, which is merging with the Brazilian airline called TAM, and it's going to form LATAM, is going to be the number one or number two most higher market cap airline in the world after that merge. So we're having that kind of growth of entrepreneurship already. And what we want to do is to foster that growth by better interconnecting Chile with the innovation centers of the world as California, Ireland, Singapore, Israel. We think we may well end up being the sort of... like Singapore is to China, we may end up being the South American Singapore to Brazil, let's say, or something of that sort. Or Ireland to Europe has a similar relationship. Small, open economies connected to a large fast-growing market. And in order to better then to improve this connection, I'm going to skip this. We are doing a lot of things. I'm not going to extend much on this, but basically what we want is to improve the connection between Chile and the innovation centers like California. For example, here we have a mission of Chilean entrepreneurs with us, here in the first row, that are part of a presidential mission. They came with me to California, and they are going to join a presidential mission to Los Angeles and San Francisco. You know, to get them to know better this how this ecosystem works, and how and to connect with VC investors. We are having this starting this program that was mentioned, the what we call the Startup Chile program, in which we are bringing to Chile young entrepreneurs that want to spend their early stages of the development of their ideas working in Chile. We are granting them money to do that. And the reason we are thinking that is interesting is because that is going to create a sort of critical mass of entrepreneurs in Chile, and it's going to improve because those entrepreneurs, and I hope many of you could be there, would have better connections with Chile, and somehow that connection is going to last during their professional and business careers. We are also opening up the possibility of Chilean entrepreneurs coming here to Californian incubators. We're also helping or supporting from the government side the locating in Chile of IT world companies willing to set there their or do their global services. We are also supporting the installation in Chile of centers of excellence. So there's a lot of things we are doing basically to create this innovation hub. And I think we're going to make it. And some people say we may well end up being, let's say, 20, 30, or 50 years from now, like California is today. So that provides a window of opportunity to actually go to Chile now and invest there. And you see the similarities are very clear. That's the Atacama Desert. That's Napa Valley, and that's... Oh, there's a problem here. Ah, well, there's the Chilean... vineyards, and that's the coast, the central coast of California and Chile being very, very similar. So we are starting by the landscape, the physical landscape, but we are going to end up by changing the economic and social landscape of Chile. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.